Hi, from the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater. We'll turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Wednesday, April 24th, USA Today. Our first op-ed is written by Larry Strauss. It's titled, Fast Food Businesses Hiking Prices Because of Higher Minimum Wage Sound Like Gordon Gekko. Conservative economists have been warning us about the dangers of raising the minimum wage for as long as I can remember, which is back to when I earned about $2 an hour, the federal minimum wage in 1975. So it should be no surprise that in California, which recently raised the minimum wage for large fast food chains to at least $20 an hour, up from $16 an hour, those restaurants are raising prices, or threatening to, and planning to increase the use of kiosks to replace counter workers, though plans for such automation were already likely in place. I remember when it was commonplace to hear arguments for abolishing the minimum wage. Let the free market sort out wages and prices, went the logic. Government intervention leads to inflation and unemployment. My college economics professor made the case passionately. If you don't like your pay, get another job, get trained, go back to school, etc. The economy works best and grows fastest when everyone is out for themselves. Sure, people will fall through the cracks, just don't let it be you. I was reminded of this when I watched the first Wall Street movie in which Gordon Gekko, played brilliantly by Michael Douglas and not accidentally named, though spelled slightly differently, after a reptile, gives the famous greed is good speech to the shareholders of a company he wishes to take over and pillage. Greed, for lack of a better word, is good, Gekko says. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, for knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Telder Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. His reference to the evolutionary spirit seems an obvious nod on the part of screenwriter Oliver Stone, also the film's director, and Stanley Weiser, to the social Darwinism of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a bogus theory used to justify racism and other inhumanity, a cinematic commentary on the shameless rapacity of corporate raiders during the 1980s. I'm afraid that evolutionary spirit is very much with us today. Billionaires less interested in curbing climate change than preparing their personal bunkers to survive it. An airplane manufacturer that apparently has been putting profit ahead of safety. Firearms manufacturers and the politicians who carry their water, who seem to believe that any sale of a weapon is a good sale, even if it is to someone with mental illness or a grudge against a former spouse or coworker, even if the results in mass slaughter. And all of the manner of other corporations maximizing profits regardless of the harm. Such craveness is often justified by the principle of shareholder primacy, the belief that corporations are bound by an obligation to maximize profits for the sake of their shareholders and those of us who own stock or mutual funds or have a public pension are the financial beneficiaries of such blind loyalty to profit. But not all of us wish to be held morally hostage by our financial futures. I believe there are many people like me with a modest share of the collective prosperity who are willing to enjoy a smaller financial return for the sake of those trying to subsist on the minimum wage in economically depressed communities. We find it outrageous that multi-billion-dollar corporations begrudge their workers a living wage and are willing to take it out on their own disadvantaged customers. According to the National Council of State Legislatures, 34 states, territories, and districts have minimum wages above $7.25 an hour. Georgia and Wyoming have a minimum below that. Five states have not adopted a state minimum: Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Tennessee. The federal minimum wage governs those seven states. That economics professor of mine used to say that capitalism was human nature, that competing for resources and consolidating wealth were as natural as the flowers in the spring. I thought he made sense then, but after 32 years teaching mostly underprivileged children, I am no longer so sure. I am paid for my work and am not shy about demanding compensation, though, like many teachers, I often do more than I am required. I don't mind it because what I get from helping students overcome their circumstances is worth more to me than my hourly wage. This is something over which affluent friends have expressed envy. Perhaps some of that is patronizing, but I am quite sure that the endless pursuit of wealth really is a shallow endeavor, doomed to leave most people feeling rather empty. Many smart people know this and try to balance their lives to pursue financial stability, but not at the expense of their souls. Wouldn't we all be better if the laws that govern business reflected that more? Wouldn't the future of humanity benefit from the most powerful corporations making a sincere commitment to the communities that make them so wealthy? Next, from the Wednesday, April 24th, New York Times, an op-ed written by Michelle Cottle is titled, "The Humbling of Marjorie Taylor Greene." In our Trump-era politics, there's always the question of how crazy is too crazy, how disruptive and extreme an elected official can get before becoming so embarrassing that members of her own team feel compelled to abandon her. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene seems to have reached that outer limit again. It's not simply that Ms. Greene has taken such a Putin-pleasing approach to Russia's war in Ukraine. Ukrainian Nazis, really? That the term useful idiot feels unavoidable. She has, in very little time, undermined the influence of her party's entire right flank, driving less unhinged Republicans, most notably the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, to brush back her and her ilk like the poo-flinging chaos monkeys that they are. Just look at what has come to pass in the House in the past several days. Mr. Johnson, a proud ultra-conservative, pushed through a $95 billion foreign aid package, including $60 billion for Ukraine, with more Democratic votes than Republican ones. He is now counting on Democrats to save him from the Green-led extremist plan to defenestrate him and install yet another Republican as Speaker. There is much buzz about the emergence of a bipartisan governing coalition in the House, albeit one born of desperation. Squint hard and Congress almost looks to be functioning as intended, with a majority of members coming together to advance vital legislation. With her special brand of MAGA extremism, Ms. Greene has shifted the House in a bipartisan direction, at least for now, in exactly the way her base loathes. Can I get two cheers for the art of the possible? On a less-minded note, how delicious was it to see Ms. Greene on the steps of the Capitol on Saturday, raving about Mr. Johnson's various betrayals and proclaiming him a lame duck, even as she hemmed and hawed about when she would move to oust him. All in good time, she said, insisting she felt moved to let her colleagues first go home and hear from their constituents over the week's House recess. I said from the beginning, I'm going to be responsible with this, she said, in what may be her most laughable line in weeks, a high bar for the House member known for her keen insights on Jewish space lasers. Seriously, how responsible did Miss Green look on Sunday on Fox News as she ducked Maria Bartiromo's questions about her plans for ousting Mr. Johnson? Short answer, she has no plan. Ms. Bartiromo noted that Ms. Green was drawing widespread criticism for creating drama and that there was concern she was making Republicans look like a bunch of squabbling incompetents unfit to run a neighborhood book club. Those may not have been the host's exact words. Ms. Green's crackerjack defense was to insist the people criticizing me are not the American people. The American people are outraged, and what they're saying is they don't want to vote for Republicans anymore, she asserted, adding that the Republican Party in charge right now, it's no different than the Democrat Party. I may be off base here, Marjo, but trashing your colleagues as no better than the other side in a high-stakes election year is not the best way to win them over to your kamikaze mission. But here's the thing. Republicans already subjected themselves to painful mockery last fall by letting their right-wingers take down Speaker Kevin McCarthy without a succession plan in mind. It took them 3 failed candidates and 3 inglorious weeks to finally install Mr. Johnson. Precious few members are likely up for a second helping of humiliation this much closer to Election Day. I mean, not even Donald Trump is throwing in with Moscow Marjorie, as she has been dubbed in some cheekier conservative corners. After an invigorating Monday spent in court, the former president reiterated his support and sympathy for Mr. Johnson in a chat with the conservative radio host John Fredericks. Well, look, we have a majority of 1, okay, Mr. Trump noted. It's not like he can go and do whatever he wants to do. At this point, the most enthusiastic base of support for Ms. Green's shenanigans may be the Kremlin. More food for thought, Congresswoman. When Russian propagandists start praising your politics and beauty, it's time to rethink your life choices. Could this show of spying by non-winger Republicans last more than a hot second? Maybe Mr. Johnson is recognizing that his responsibilities as the head of the People's House go beyond serving his trolliest, most obstructionist members. And maybe, unlike Mr. McCarthy, who never exhibited signs of possessing a moral core, Mr. Johnson is serious about trying to do the right thing, by which he does not simply mean whatever Mr. Trump tells him to do. Of course, if we really want to talk fantasy scenarios, I'd be thrilled if this speaker, having stiff-armed his wingers multiple times and lived to tell about it, feels liberated to keep nudging the House toward greater functionality. I mean, the guy has already blown his shot at being the ultimate MAGA speaker. Why not give being a genuine statesman a chance and do a deal on border security or the cost of prescription drugs? Not that I'm holding my breath. In these MAGA-tastic times, the humbled Ms. Green could rebound faster than you can say total presidential immunity. But for now, her flapping and flailing are satisfying to behold. Next, from the New York Times, an op-ed written by Mike Moshewski and Michael D. Swain. It's titled, A Dangerous Game is Underway in Asia. This month, President Biden threw one of the most lavish state dinners in Washington's recent memory. Celebrities and billionaires flocked to the White House to dine in honor of Prime Minister Fumio Kishida of Japan, posing for photos in front of an elaborate display of Japanese fans. Jeff Bezos dropped by. Paul Simon provided the entertainment. The spectacle was part of a carefully orchestrated series of events to showcase the renewed U.S.-Japan relationship and the notable transformation of the United States security alliances in Asia. The next day, President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. of the Philippines was also in the United States Capitol for a historic U.S.-Japan-Philippines summit, during which a new trilateral security partnership was announced. Both events were directed at the same audience, China. Over the past several years, Washington has built a series of multilateral security arrangements like these in the Asia-Pacific region. Although U.S. officials claim that the recent mobilization of allies and partners is not aimed at China, don't believe it. Indeed, Mr. Kishida emphasized in a speech to Congress on April 11th that China presents the greatest strategic challenge both to Japan and the international community. China's recent activity is, of course, concerning. Its military has acquired ever more potent ways to counter U.S. and allied capabilities in the Western Pacific, and has behaved aggressively in the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, and elsewhere, alarming its neighbors. But Washington's pursuit of an increasingly complex lattice of security ties is a dangerous game. Those ties include upgrades in defense capabilities, more joint military exercises, deeper intelligence sharing, new initiatives on defense production and technology cooperation, and the enhancement of contingency planning and military coordination. All of that may make Beijing more cautious about the blatant use of military force in the region. But the new alliance structure is not, on its own, a long-term guarantor of regional peace and stability, and could even increase the risk of stumbling into a conflict. The security partnership rolled out this month in Washington is only the latest in a string of new defense configurations that reach across Asia and the Pacific. In 2017, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, known as the Quad, was revived, promoting collaboration among the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. In September 2021, Australia, Britain, and the United States began their partnership known as AUKUS, and the United States, Japan, and South Korea committed to closer cooperation in a summit at Camp David last August. All of these moves have been motivated primarily by concern over Beijing, which has, in turn, castigated these countries as being part of a U.S.-led effort to create an Asian version of NATO designed to contain China. None amount to a collective defense pact like the NATO Treaty, whose Article 5 considers an armed attack on one member as an attack against them all. But China will nevertheless almost certainly regard the latest agreement among the United States, Japan, and the Philippines, with which it is engaged in an active territorial dispute, as further confirmation of a Washington-led attempt to threaten its interests. It's not yet clear how Beijing will respond, but it may double down on the expansion of its military capabilities and intensify its use of military and paramilitary force to assert its territorial claims in the region, especially regarding the sensitive issue of Taiwan. Beijing could also promote further Chinese military cooperation with Russia in the form of enhanced military exercises and deployments. The net result may be an Asia-Pacific region that is even more divided and dangerous than it is today, marked by a deepening arms race. In this increasingly contentious and militarized environment, the chance of some political incident or military accident triggering a devastating regional war is likely to grow. This is especially likely given the absence of meaningful U.S. and allied crisis communication channels with China to prevent such an incident from spiraling out of control. To prevent this nightmare, the U.S. and its allies and partners must invest much more in diplomacy with China, in addition to bolstering military deterrence. For a start, the United States and key allies like Japan should make a sustained effort to establish a durable crisis prevention and management dialogue with China involving each nation's foreign policy and security agencies. So far, such dialogues have been limited primarily to military channels and topics. It is critical that both civilian and military officials understand the many possible sources of inadvertent crises and develop ways to prevent them or manage them if they occur. This process should include the establishment of an agreed-upon set of leaders' best practices for crisis management and a trusted but unofficial channel through which the relevant parties can discuss crisis-averting understandings. The immediate focus for the United States and Japan should be on avoiding actions that add to tensions across the Taiwan Strait. The deployment of American military trainers to Taiwan on what looks like a permanent basis and suggestions by some U.S. officials and policy analysts that Taiwan be treated as a security linchpin within the overall U.S. defense posture in Asia are needlessly provocative. They also openly contradict America's long-standing One China policy, under which the United States ended the deployment of all U.S. military forces to Taiwan and does not view Taiwan as a key U.S. security location, caring only that the Taiwan issue be handled peacefully and without coercion. Japan, for its part, has also become more circumspect about its own One China policy by being reluctant to reaffirm explicitly that Tokyo does not support Taiwan's independence. Recent statements by some political leaders in Tokyo about Japanese military forces being ready to help defend Taiwan will almost certainly inflame Chinese leaders who remember that Japan seized Taiwan after the Sino-Japanese War of 1894 and 95. Washington and Tokyo should clearly reaffirm their previous commitments on the China-Taiwan dispute. Tokyo also should confirm that it does not support any unilateral move by Taiwan toward independence and resist U.S. efforts to compel Japan to commit to Taiwan's defense. Although American officials have reportedly been prodding Japan to join military planning for a Taiwan conflict, a large majority of Japanese residents do not favor fighting to defend Taiwan. Tokyo can best contribute to deterring China by focusing on strengthening its ability to defend its own islands. Washington and its allies should shift to a more positive approach to China aimed at fostering accommodation and restraint. This could include working to secure credible mutual assurances regarding limits on Chinese military deployments, such as amphibious forces and missile capabilities relevant to Taiwan, in return for U.S. limits on the levels and types of arms that it sells to the island. They could also explore increasing security cooperation with China regarding cyber attacks, the defense of sea lanes, and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, as well as better collaboration to combat climate change in the outbreak of another pandemic. China, of course, has its own role to play. In the end, Beijing, like the United States, wants to avoid a crisis and conflict in the region. Given that, it should respond to a more cooperative American and allied approach by moderating its own coercive behavior regarding maritime disputes. None of this will be easy, given the intense suspicion that now exists between Beijing and Washington and its allies. But new thinking and new diplomatic efforts could incentivize China to reciprocate in meaningful ways. At the very least, it's necessary to try. Focusing on military deterrence alone won't work. Trying to find a way to cooperate with China is the best way, perhaps the only way, to steer the world away from disaster. And we're going to jump back to the USA Today for our final op-ed. It's written by Rex Hupke, entitled, "Why Aren't the MAGA Faithful Protesting Trump's Trial or Pity Party?" I am told over and over again that former President Donald Trump's MAGA faithful are legion, that they will follow him to the ends of the earth, and that his support is massive and unparalleled. But for some reason, the area outside and around Trump's ongoing criminal trial pity party in Manhattan has been largely MAGA-free. It seems almost rude to a man who boasts of being beloved. Perhaps the invitations got lost in the mail. While Trump sits in a Manhattan criminal courtroom day after day simply because evidence led a grand jury to indict him on 34 counts of falsifying business records as part of a scheme to influence the 2016 presidential election, the streets of New York City and the rest of America remain untaken to. On Monday, Trump got on social media and beckoned his followers to protest. Go out and peacefully protest, rally behind MAGA. But as the New York Times reported, the all-caps rallying at a park across the courthouse has been a bit lowercase. Over the last week, demonstrators visibly identifying as supporting Mr. Trump with red hats or clothing or banners and flags have never totaled more than a dozen. On most days, the number of people total in the portion of the park designated for protesters for or against Mr. Trump has never been more than two or three dozen. Of course, Trump might not be helping his cause. While inviting MAGA fans to come out, he has been simultaneously and wrongly claiming that the area around the courthouse is completely closed down, declaring it so unfair. He should also be on trial for excessive use of exclamation points. There are a lot of them in that last statement. In his report, the Times noted the area was not, in fact, completely closed down. The courthouse has remained open to the public, including spectators who want to attend the trial, pool cameras in the hallway. And even the sidewalk in front of the courthouse has remained open to pedestrian traffic. 20 minutes later, Mr. Trump compared the courthouse to an armed camp. On Tuesday, before the trial resumed, Trump talked to reporters like a kid, trying to explain why nobody came to his birthday party. "It's interesting outside for great Americans, people who want to come down if they want to protest at the court, if they want to protest peacefully. We have more police presence here than anyone's ever seen. For blocks, you can't get near this courthouse." Shortly after that, an NBC reporter posted video from outside the courthouse on social media and wrote, "Trump just claimed that the police have shut down the streets around the courthouse for blocks and that his protesters can't be here. Just not true. There is one pro-Trump person here, and the main street along the courthouse is open to traffic." After leaving court on Tuesday, Trump posted this on social media. "Thousands of people were turned away from the courthouse in Lower Manhattan by steel stanchions and police, literally blocks from the tiny side door from where I enter and leave. It's an armed camp to keep people away." That's a weird and sad little fantasy, which is strange, as I've never known Trump to lie or exaggerate. Before the trial began on April 15th, the Trump campaign was hyping the chaos that would ensue once the courtroom drama began, sending out a fundraising email with the subject line, "72 hours until all hell breaks loose." The email reiterated, "If we fail to have a massive outpouring of peaceful, patriotic support right here, right now, all hell will break loose." The trial started, and shockingly, all hell remained decidedly non-loose. Well, that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. I've been reading from the editorial and opinion pages of the Wednesday, April 24th, USA Today and New York Times. I'm Barry Slater. Thank you for listening, and so long until next time.